Yesterday we had one from the complex sciences of biology, so tonight I'll give you one from the simple sciences of physics and mathematics. And when we talk about brand new discoveries, this is so new it's not yet in the peer-reviewed literature. It's a preprint, and you can get it at the Los Alamos website for physics preprints. And many of you are probably aware of the fine-tuning problem of the protons and the neutrons inside the cell. I mean, I was taught that when I was in junior high school, how you've got the electromagnetic force, which causes protons to repel one another. And you'd say, well, how can you get protons to stick together in the nucleus? Well, it's because of the strong nuclear force. The strong nuclear force is not very powerful at all at large distances. But when you get down to what's called a fermion, you say, what on earth is a fermion? A fermion is 1/4 of a meter. So that's approximately into the inner dimensions of the nucleus of the atom. So take 1/4 of a meter, and that's how close the protons and neutrons are jammed together in the nucleus. And when particles get that close together, then the strong nuclear force becomes so powerful it's able to dominate the repulsive force of electromagnetism. However, because it's weak beyond a fermion, that means it's possible for the electrons to orbit about the center of the nucleus. You can get atoms, you can get molecules. If the strong nuclear force operate over large distances, distances greater than a fermion, then you wouldn't be able to have atoms or molecules, and therefore you wouldn't have life. On the other hand, if the strong nuclear force wasn't powerful enough for the protons and neutrons to stick together in the nucleus, then you wouldn't have anything besides hydrogen, hydrogen being a single proton. So we do need this strong nuclear force. And as I mentioned in my book, The Creator and the Cosmos and the Fingerprint of God, if you were to make that force slightly more powerful than what we observe, then all you would get would be extremely heavy nuclei. The universe would be filled with nothing but elements heavier than iron. That being the case, you'd have a universe where there'd be no carbon, no oxygen, no nitrogen, no hydrogen, and no possibility for life. On the other hand, if you made that force slightly weaker than what we observe, then all you would have would be the element hydrogen. Notice that either way, you don't get carbon, oxygen, or nitrogen. You say, well, how fine-tuned do we have to make that force? Change it by about 1%. Make it 1% stronger or 1% weaker at the level of a fermion. There'd be no possibility for life to ever exist anywhere, anytime in the universe. And this is one of the more famous fine-tuning arguments for concluding that the universe indeed has been supernaturally designed for the benefit of life. Because it's not just one characteristic, there's 140 different fundamental constants of physics where you need this kind of fine-tuning at that level or even much greater. But what's in this paper? It's investigating a second level of fine-tuning inside the nucleus. And some of you may realize protons and neutrons are made up of more fundamental particles. Protons and neutrons themselves are not fundamental particles. They're made up of quarks and gluons. And so every proton and every neutron you can think of as a little bag filled with quarks and gluons that hold it all together. But one of the things that particle physicists have been pondering is what is it that prevents all these quarks and gluons that are inside the protons and the neutrons from simply forming one gigantic bag? I mean, why do we even have protons and neutrons in the nucleus? Given how these particles operate, we would expect that they would all just simply blend together into one gigantic bag of quarks and gluons. That doesn't happen. You know, every proton and every neutron contains three quarks. So there's three in one bag and three in the other bag. And what particle physicists observe is there seems to be a powerful repulsive force that prevents the protons and neutrons, or these bags of gluons and quarks, from blending together to make one gigantic bag. And, you know, if that were to happen, we would have no nuclear chemistry. There wouldn't be, hydrogen helium, carbon, oxygen, nitrogen, iron, uranium, and thorium. We would just simply have these enormous bags, either that or flow-freeing particles, where we'd have quarks and gluons that just be running around on their own. And what particle physicists recognized some years ago is that the strong nuclear force is not only an attractive force, it's attractive and repulsive. So it's the strangest of all the forces of physics in that it's neither repulsive nor attractive at lengths beyond about a fermion. But once you get down to about a fermion, it becomes powerfully attractive. But once you get down to about a tenth of a fermion, it reverses and becomes powerfully repulsive. And because of that repulsive nature of the strong nuclear force at very short lengths, that's what prevents these bags of quarks and gluons from simply blending together to become one gigantic bag. And what we realize is there's two levels of fine-tuning in the strong nuclear force. The attractive part of it must be exquisitely fine-tuned, not be too strong or not be too weak in order to get all the elements we see in the atomic chart. It also must be fine-tuned to operate over a particular length scale. It needs to operate over about a single fermion, a little bit more, a little bit less, but not a whole lot more, a whole lot less. And then we see two levels of more fine-tuning. It must be extremely repulsive, but again, not too repulsive, and we don't want it to be too less of a repulsive force when we're down at about a tenth of a fermion or less, and we need to fine-tune that length level over where it is extremely repulsive. So if you don't have those four independent levels of fine-tuning in the strong nuclear force, fine-tuning on the degree of attractiveness and the length scale over which that degree of attractiveness operates, and then fine-tune the degree of repulsion and fine-tune the length scale over which it operates, if all four of those are not fine-tuned, you'll not get the carbon, the oxygen, the nitrogen, and all the other elements that are essential for life chemistry. Now, that much was known 2 years ago. Okay, what's brand new, and what's in this paper, is they said, okay, we've done experiments in particle physics accelerators to prove all this fine-tuning. However, we've not been able to develop or to test a theoretical model for this fine-tuning. And many of you may be aware that Richard Feynman won the Nobel Prize over at Caltech. You know, he was kind of a local legend in the Pasadena area. He used to walk his dogs up in the hills here, and you know, people would run into him and talk to him about physics. He won the Nobel Prize for coming up with a theory of quantum chromodynamics, or QCD. And it was thought all along that this quantum chromodynamics would answer the question of why the strong nuclear force is simultaneously repulsive and attractive at one length scale and extremely repulsive at a shorter length scale. And Richard Feynman surmised that this is because you had two families of mesons, another class of fundamental particles, the pi mesons, which would regulate that part of the strong nuclear force where it's attractive, and then heavier mesons, which would regulate the repulsive part. But until now, we've lacked the mathematics, or more accurately, the computing power to test whether or not Richard Feynman's quantum chromodynamics is the right answer for explaining this degree of fine-tuning. And for several years, it was considered impossible to run this kind of test because we lacked the computing power. Well, now we've got computers that run at faster than teraflop speeds. And what happened here is that three Japanese were able to get a hold of one of these computers. I mean, we're talking about the world's most powerful computer. And they ran this problem, or actually what they ran was just one tiny piece of the problem, on the computer for 6 months. So the computer ran nonstop for 6 months. And just think of it, the world's most powerful computer running nonstop for 6 months on just one segment of this problem of quantum chromodynamics. And what's so exciting about the paper, it's the first time that any group of physicists have been able to work out in some detail the solution to this quantum chromodynamic theory that Richard Feynman had developed nearly 30 years ago. Won the Nobel Prize for it, got the Nobel Prize because experiments showed that what he predicted was correct, but we've never been able to really flesh out the theory. These three Japanese were able to do it, thanks to a company giving him this computer to run nonstop for 6 months. And they were able to show that indeed the quantum chromodynamic model does explain the fine-tuning, but in the process, they uncovered the potential for a whole lot more fine-tuning that no one could see in the first place. So, you know, I mentioned four levels of fine-tuning that we could see with the experiments. What this theory now shows is, and I'm just going to read you a quote from their study. It said, "It will be important to consider, however, with current computers," and they say important to consider, we're looking at probably years of running the computers nonstop, several of these world's most powerful computers nonstop. We're probably going to have to wait for another generation of computing power to come forward. But what they're proposing in the paper is this. It would be important, and they also use the word fun, it would be important and fun to consider how the strong nuclear force gets modified as we change the masses of the U, the D, and the S quarks. Those are the three quarks that make up the protons and the neutrons. How the masses of the quarks, how the pressure operating on these quarks, and the would tinker with the underlying theory over what range of parameters does this hardcore repulsion persist, and so allow complex nuclear chemistry, and therefore life, to exist. We're hoping we will get fresh ideas and understanding of how fine-tuned the fundamental parameters must be in order to produce a user-friendly universe. That is, a universe that would permit the existence of theoretical physicists. And what they're suggesting here is that in order to explain these four levels of fine-tuning, it's going to be critical to fine-tune the masses of all three quarks. We're going to have to fine-tune the properties of the gluons that cause these quarks to stick together and to repulse at shorter wavelengths. And we're going to have to fine-tune the pressure parameters, and maybe we can discover even more characteristics that might be fine-tuned. So the bottom line is, what this research paper did was to confirm the fine-tuning design that experimentalists have been able to show concerning the strong nuclear force, and uncover the potential for studying many other levels of fine-tuning that even 6 months of computing power running nonstop have not yet been able to produce. But what it has done is open up the door for a lot more research on this fine-tuning, yes. Fermion is 1/4 of a meter, or if you prefer the notation, it's 10^-13 centimeters. So it's roughly the diameter of a typical nucleus of an atom. So if you look at a typical nucleus, say take the carbon atom where you got six protons and six neutrons held together in a nucleus, the diameter of that nucleus is roughly a fermion. Oh, much longer than Planck's length, yes. Yeah, much longer. So, and when, you know, we're talking, but you know, if you try to jam these things closer together where the quarks are threatening to fuse together, that's where the repulsive force kicks in. So it's highly repulsive at 1/10 fermion and extremely attractive at 1 fermion, and at 10 fermions you don't get any force at all. I mean, it really is the strangest of all the forces of physics, because, you know, if you take electromagnetism or gravity, they operate on all lengths. And they operate in a very predictable way, depending on the length. Gravity is a very weak force, and it's easily overcome by electromagnetism when you're talking about molecules and atoms. Actually, there is symmetry. I didn't get into that, but what's in this research paper is that we're discovering symmetries that we didn't know existed until we had this kind of computing power. And as we push this computing power to the next level, those symmetries are going to reveal fine-tuning design that we've not yet been able to see. I mean, what's exciting to me about this paper from a Christian perspective, you know, if you look at the book of Job and the book of Psalms and the book of Habakkuk, there's a principle in there that the more the human observer reads and studies the record of nature, the more evidence that human observer will find for the handiwork of God. And this is a good example. The more you dig into the physics of this strong nuclear force, the more evidence we're uncovering for this supernatural, superintelligent fine-tuning design. Now, we found some a few years ago, but thanks to these supercomputers, we're going to be finding more. Okay.
Well, I'm going to open the questions up, Hugh, with one of the good ones that I got on a piece of paper here. I've really had a tough time understanding previous responses to this question. Regarding the apparent contradiction of an all-knowing, all-powerful God and free will, how does the Bible and or science validate our ability to act freely, or is it an illusion?
Well, I don't think it's an illusion, and I'll try to give a short answer to this. If you want a really long answer, you'll find it in the book on the table there called Beyond the Cosmos, where we take several chapters to resolve this paradox of human free choice and divine predestination. People have called it a contradiction, and you know, I often get that from skeptics. Matter of fact, I remember about 25 years ago, we did a door-to-door survey in an Arcadia neighborhood and talked to non-Christians there about the reason why they could not accept Jesus Christ as their Creator, Lord, and Savior. And we were surprised to discover that 15% of the people we interviewed gave this question that Ross brought to the microphone as their primary reason for not giving their life to Christ. They saw this contradiction. You know, how can God predetermine all of our thoughts, words, and actions and yet claim to give us the freedom to choose? Is that just seems like a contradiction. And the point I make in Beyond the Cosmos is it does appear contradictory and would be contradictory if we were to confine God's operations to the same dimensions in which we all live and operate, namely length, width, height, and time. But that there are discoveries in physics that have been made that establish that the creator of the universe is not confined to a single dimension of time and is not confined to three dimensions of space. And what I take some pains to do in the book is show how if you allow God to operate in a dimensional room that physics by itself demonstrates must exist, there are actually several solutions to how God can predetermine all of our thoughts, words, and actions and yet give us complete freedom to choose and determine our destiny. It only appears to be a contradiction if you restrict it to those dimensions we humans experience. Now, for a lot of people, that's not good enough, because what I found outside the physics department and the mathematics department is you run into people who insist that if they can't visualize a solution to a problem, then that means there is no solution to the problem. But one of the things we get early in our physics training is there's all kinds of things in physics and astronomy and mathematics that we know are true and we know the solution is correct, but we can't form a visual picture of that solution in our mind. And you know, I've brought a few of these to this forum before. You know, for example, astronomers can prove that the universe's surface is really like a four-dimensional system. And we all live on the three-dimensional surface of the four-dimensional expanding universe. But I can tell you from personal experience, I have not met a single astronomer who can visually describe what the four-dimensional universe looks like. We can do it with mathematics, but we can't make a visual description. And one example I gave in Beyond the Cosmos is an exercise I was given as a sophomore mathematics student at the University of British Columbia, which was to demonstrate that if you've got four independent dimensions of space, you can take a basketball and turn it inside out without disturbing the surface of the basketball. You can do it without making a cut or a hole in the surface of the basketball. Now, what the mathematics professor did for us, he showed us a little video that proved to us that this really does work in four dimensions. But he did it the way an architect shows you what your home is going to look like. He showed it to us just two dimensions at a time. Now, you know how an architect's plans work. They show you the plan view of the home looking down from above and various side views. But because you live in three dimensions, you're capable of taking those independent two-dimensional images of your home and kind of putting it together in your head, and you can figure out what your house looks like. However, what our physics professor did is to show us two-dimensional clips showing us how the basketball is being turned inside out. We got to see it two dimensions at a time. So we got to see it from all those different two-dimensional perspectives. So we actually saw the whole phenomena in the four dimensions. But neither the mathematics professor nor any of us in the class could actually make a visual picture in our head of that basketball being turned inside out without making a cut or a hole in the surface of the basketball. And then he had us go through the exercise of proving it mathematically. And the whole point is there's all kinds of things we can prove, but the rigor of mathematics must be true, but we can't make a visual construct in our mind of how that would work and operate. Well, the same thing's true of predestination and free will. But what I've done in the book, I think the easiest way to show how they can both be true and not contradict one another is to conceive of a God working in three independent dimensions of time. And I think I can do that for you right here. At least get you to the point of foreknowledge. Because it tells us in the book of Romans and the book of Ephesians that God foreknows. He foreknows and he predestinates. And so God, from his current perspective, knows everything that's going to happen in the future. And what we can do is kind of just visualize that I've got up here in front of me a sphere of time. So just think I've got a giant beach ball here. And you know what I've done in some TV shows is actually kind of bring a beach ball in front of an audience and show them how it works. But what we're going to do, just visualize this beach ball, and we're going to draw an equator around that beach ball. Okay, and we're going to have a little segment of that equator represent the timeline of the universe. So say you could make a segment that runs one quarter of the way along the equator of that beach ball. And the beginning of that line would be the creation of the universe 13.73 billion years ago, and the end of the line would be the present moment. Now, what you could do is put God at the north pole of that sphere, and from the north pole of that sphere, God would be able to drop a perpendicular timeline that would meet the beginning of the universe. He could drop another perpendicular timeline that meets the present of the universe, a third perpendicular timeline that drops down to that equator and meets the date that you were born, and a fourth one where he drops a perpendicular timeline and it meets that day in the future when you're going to die. The interesting thing is all four of those perpendicular lines along our 13.73 billion years of history meet at a single instant of time at the north pole of the sphere. So from that perspective, you can visualize how God could simultaneously operate over 13.73 billion years of history. So in that sense, I think we can at least visualize the foreknowledge part. Now, much more challenging is to visualize exactly how God can predetermine all our thoughts, words, and actions without damaging in any way our free will. Now, I'm going to recommend you go to the book because it would take me quite a bit of time to try to use the blackboard to show you how it works. There's about 15 diagrams in the book that try to show you. And what I do in the book is show you three different ways that God could do it if he had access to three dimensions of time. If he's got access to three dimensions of time, I give you three rather different solutions to how God can predestinate and yet grant us free will. Now, I'm willing to concede that I may be wrong on all three of my suggested solutions. But the whole point is, without a lot of fancy mathematics, I can give you three solutions. And you're given that God can create any number of space-time dimensions he wishes and remove them whenever he wishes. He would obviously have millions of independent solutions to the problem of free will and predestination, human free will and divine predestination. And and the reason I chose the three solutions that I did is because I think they have some biblical basis in the writings of the Apostle Paul. And this may be critical. In the sense, the Apostle Paul made the point in the letters he wrote to the Thessalonians and to his protege Timothy, is he made the point that when we human beings make a decision, it's not just our decision component that plays a role. There's actually three components in every decision we human beings make throughout the entire life. Now, one that we all can, I think, recognize is that there is our own will that comes into play. And so when I make a decision to pick up this book, my will is definitely involved in making that decision. But the Apostle Paul says that there's two other components. There's the will of Jesus Christ that is a factor, and there's the will of Satan. Now, the point Paul makes is that when you make a decision in your life, you can decide to make the kind of decision that Satan would make concerning that issue. In other words, you can side with him, or you can side with Jesus Christ. In other words, every decision you make is a decision where you can think it through and say, okay, what would Jesus do and what would Satan do? And one thing you can count on, they will come up with something opposite. They're not going to agree. They don't agree on anything. Now, that's a guarantee. They don't agree on anything. But in every decision you make, you've got Satan tugging at you and you've got Christ tugging at you. And what you do in terms of what you decide is based on adding up the Christ component, the Satan component, and your component. Now, what's interesting about the Christ component and the Satan component is they're opposite. One will be this direction, the other will be the opposite direction. And also, the magnitude of their will is predictable. Now, the magnitude of your will is not predictable. And you probably observe that. Sometimes you make decisions, you're ambivalent. Like when my wife asked me, what restaurant do you want to eat at tonight? Well, often I really don't have a strong opinion, and where I ask her, you know, where do you want to eat? Because I know her opinion is probably going to be much stronger than my opinion. And you know, one I really watch out for is when my wife asks me, honey, which of these dresses do you think I should buy? Well, I know she's got a much stronger opinion than I have, so I kind of watch out for that one. And that's the way it is. Some things we feel very strongly about, and some things we're rather ambivalent about. And so what I've done in the book is kind of give you what I call a vector diagram analysis. And that's kind of a physics term for the direction of the vector. And by choosing a length of the vector, that kind of represents how strongly you're expressing your will. And so we human beings can choose to have a very long vector on our decision component, or a short vector where we really don't care. And we can express that will of ours in the direction of Christ, or we can express it against the direction of Christ, namely the direction of Satan. But the point the Apostle Paul makes is this. Every time you make a decision to follow Christ in your life and do as Jesus Christ would do, that has the effect of increasing the strength of the Christ component in your decision-making process, and conversely, it weakens the Satan component. And likewise, when you make a decision to follow Satan and rebel against Jesus Christ, it does the opposite. And a decision at that level will cause the Satan component to become stronger and the Christ component to become weaker. You know, that's as much as the Apostle Paul says. He doesn't tell you exactly how much it becomes weaker and stronger, only that it does. Moreover, the Apostle Paul doesn't really tell you how you start off when you're born. We don't know. It could be that we all start off at different levels. We don't know that either. Those would be interesting theological questions to pose. But frankly, I don't think we've got good answers for that. But it does allow you to appreciate how it is, from a biblical perspective, someone can become a captive of Christ, or someone can become a captive of Satan. You know, yesterday when we did this Skeptics Forum, some people wanted to know about blasphemy against the Holy Spirit, where people, through their decision-making process, degrade to such a level of wickedness that they're incapable of doing anything good or even thinking anything good in their thought life. And that happens to people who have rebelled so consistently against the will of the Creator of the universe that they've made the Satan component in their life so extremely strong and the Christ component so extremely weak that it doesn't matter how they express their will. Now, in one sense, you can argue that the individual was the one that decided to make the Satan component that strong. You know, through all of his decisions he's been making or she's been making for the past 40 or 50 years, he or she consciously chose to make the Satan component in their life that powerful. But it does explain why Scripture says that for certain individuals, God gives up on them. They've reached a point of no return. But the positive side is that you can choose to follow Christ to a certain degree where you become a captive of Christ's will. And you wonder how it is that in the Bible it tells us that God can guarantee that we will enjoy eternal fellowship with Him in heaven for all of eternity. He offers that guarantee to people who have exercised their will consistently enough throughout their life that they've reached a point where that captivity of Christ will become a certainty. Doesn't mean that you're a total captive of Christ yet, but it means you've reached a point where there's no doubt that's what's going to happen in your life. So that's kind of the basis of the three solutions I offer in the book. Just kind of work out the vector diagram, see how it goes under different circumstances. And I say that because God's got lots of options that we can speculate about. He's in control of the rheostat on his will and Satan's will, and where we start in life in terms of Satan's will and Christ's will. He's also in control of our circumstances. So by manipulating our circumstances, he can affect how that decision would work and operate. But you know, the Bible doesn't tell us which of those options God uses. And if I were to invoke several more dimensions of space and time, I could easily imagine a million independent solutions of the problem. But no longer can the skeptic say there is no possible solution. Once we get beyond the limits of human visualization, there is a number of solutions. And Timothy and Thessalonians, in my opinion, allow us to put some boundaries from a biblical perspective on what those solutions would be. What I find most remarkable, and I'm going to end with this, is that the Bible is the only holy book that states that there's no contradiction between divine predestination and human free choice. All the other religions teach one or the other. And that's because I believe they're invented by human beings. And because they're invented by human beings, they reveal the limitations of human visualization. Now, mathematically, I could put it this way. No one can visualize a phenomena that they're not capable of personally experiencing. And so a human being inventing a religion will not be putting into their, quote, holy book things that are impossible to visualize. That, in my opinion, explains why in all the other religions of the world, there's no Trinity. The Trinity, likewise, is something you can't visualize in four space-time dimensions. And Christianity is the only religion that describes God as a triune being. If you want to read about a whole bunch more, it's in Beyond the Cosmos. Go ahead, Charlie.
Well, I think you've answered my question because I have a very good friend of mine who is a PhD science teacher. And this teacher has just recently proclaimed with great enthusiasm that they're going to do a comparative religious study. And I was thinking along the same lines. What would you suggest that individual focus on in that comparative study, in that basis? Would it be the same thing?
Well, I think you've answered your own question.
Looking for the human
look at all the holy books and say, okay, what is in these holy books that you could get from a strictly human perspective, and what are in these holy books that you couldn't get from a strictly human perspective? I mean, I look at the predictive power of the Bible. You know, a human being living 3,500 years ago is not going to be able to predict the future thousands of years ahead of his time with 100% accuracy. So if you've got a book that can do that, that shows that its content must have come from a superhuman source. And I just gave you an example. If it contains doctrines and teachings that can't be visualized by the human mind, that's a good clue it's coming from a transcendent source. And is there any of these holy books that is content that's unique from all the other books? You know, one thing that impressed me when I first started looking at the holy books, the religions of the world.
Your testimony?
My testimony when I was 17 is that every religion has a story of humanity starting off in paradise and how they lost paradise. But where they differ from the Bible is these other religions claim that the gods are on a mission to restore us to paradise. What I found different about the Bible is its message that God is on a mission to deliver us from paradise. That paradise is described in the Bible as a place of enslavement from which God wants to deliver us. Whereas in the other religions of the world, they're saying, hey, bring it on. Paradise sounds great. But paradise is a place where Adam and Eve were constrained by the laws of physics and the dimensions of the universe, and were constrained in their ability to be intimate with one another. And what the Bible promises is us as a new creation where the shackles of physics will be stripped away, but only after the conquest of the problem of evil. That the physics of this universe is put into place to bring about the conquest of evil, and when evil is conquered, God's going to give us something much better than paradise. Well, that's another example where from a human perspective, you wouldn't come up with that kind of a teaching. You know, it tells us in 1 Corinthians 2:9, no one can think or imagine how great and good and wonderful the new creation will be. Well, what I see in the other religions of the world is they all come up with a heaven we can visualize. Only the Bible comes up with a heaven that's beyond our capacity to visualize. Again, another sign that it's from a non-human source. Now, one of the things the Bible does point out is that even if you prove it's from a non-human source, you're not done with your testing. You've got to demonstrate that it's from a good non-human source as opposed to an evil non-human source, again making the point that there are other supernatural beings that don't have your best interests at heart.
Therein lies the second part of my equation.
Okay.
Is this individual is a very, very good person. And also very non-religious at this particular time, but they help, and they do good, and they're and all the time, everywhere they go. And how can I pray about that for that individual?
Well, it's been my experience, Charlie, the hardest people to bring to faith in Jesus Christ are the good sinners. And the only thing I've seen that works with people that are good is to try to demonstrate to them that nobody is really good. You know, Jesus made that point. Only God is good. And, you know, the sermon he gave on the Mount, I think, is a powerful tool for showing people who are better than everybody else that even they are in need of salvation. You know, and that's an easy trap for somebody to fall into, where they lead a moral life. And they compare the morality to everybody around them. And I must admit, I did that as a young man. I was at the university, and I looked at all my fellow students and the professors there and said, hey, compared to their morality, I'm doing pretty well. I'm not into drugs, I'm not into sex, and you know, I'm doing great. But all you got to do is read the New Testament, and you realize that standard is woefully short of what the Creator demands. And those three chapters, Matthew 5, 6, and 7, the Sermon on the Mount, if you can get the good sinner to read that and really consider the implications of what Jesus said in the Sermon on the Mount, you might be able to break through. Now, if they have pride, you're not going to get through. But that may be one way you can minister is that, okay, what's the worst offense, the worst sin that you can commit? It's not adultery. It's not stealing. It's not murder. It's pride. And if they'll admit to their pride, you might be able to break through.
Thank you.
If they won't admit to their pride, there's no hope.
One last question. Hubble's experiments and measurements on the acceleration, and Alan Sandage followed up on that stuff, but with our new revelations of dark matter and dark energy, it's expanding and expanding at an accelerating rate. Wherein did Hubble and Alan Sandage make their mistakes on those acceleration factors that are slowing down instead of it's going faster?
Well, years ago, Hubble and Sandage and others realized that they didn't have the telescope power to investigate the expansion rate of the universe to anything better than plus or minus 30%. That's how bad it was. And what they could see was that the expansion of the universe was linear. And if it's linear, then gravity is the only factor affecting the expansion of the universe. It wasn't until we had measurements that were much better than that that we were able to see the slight nonlinearity. And it's quite remarkable, Charlie, in that the departure from a linear relationship in this redshift law is only at the 1% level. So until your measurements get down to the accuracy of a percent, you're not going to pick up that dark energy factor. And it wasn't picked up until 1999. Now, to the credit of the people like Hubble and Sandage, all along they recognized that was a possibility. Because after all, the dark energy factor was in Einstein's original equations. Well, not his original, his altered equations of general relativity. And that was in all the textbooks. We all knew about it. Einstein referred to it as the greatest blunder of his scientific career. And indeed, it was a great blunder because he had the wrong sign. He was introducing this dark energy factor to get rid of the expansion of the universe. Instead, what we realize with the opposite sign on the dark energy factor, it actually has the universe expanding more rapidly. But that was Einstein's goal originally, was to get rid of the expansion. And so he put this dark energy term to counterbalance the gravity. And in fact, the dark energy works to accelerate the expansion of the universe, not get rid of it. So he had the wrong value and the wrong sign. But now that we got precise enough measurements, we actually can pick it up. Yeah, go ahead.
I got another one off the page. I heard the Large Hadron Collider at CERN is set to go online in November of this year. From that collider, what's the one new discovery or piece of evidence to your model that you look forward to the most, and how soon do you see it coming?
Well, the hope is it will come online that soon. That's the most optimistic estimate for when it's going to come online. And all of us are hoping that that optimistic estimate proves to be correct. And it's the biggest scientific machine that's ever been built. And, you know, it's a European instrument, but the Americans were the ones that built and funded the detector. The detector on this thing is $600 million, just the detector, let alone the machine that accelerates all these particles. It's $6 billion total. So, and given the mood of the taxpayer, we're probably never going to get another machine like that. But to answer the question, the thing that I'm looking forward to, and virtually every other physicist is looking forward to, is a discovery of the Higgs boson and the measurement of the properties of the Higgs boson. Yeah, as a guy who wrote a book, not a Christian, but he wrote a book called The God Particle, and it's all about the amazing presumed characteristics of the Higgs boson. The reason why the discovery of the Higgs boson would be so phenomenal is that the creation model for particle physics posits, this is what's called the standard model of particle physics, is that you've got two kinds of fundamental particles. You've got the fermions, which are like the quarks, and then you've got the bosons. The bosons regulate the forces that operate between the particles. So you can think of the particles themselves as fermions. And particle physicists have discovered quite a number of fermions and quite a number of bosons. But they have not yet discovered a single boson-fermion pair. in other words, where you've got a fermion, and you can also identify and measure the characteristics of its relevant boson pair. You can get one or you can get the other, but you can't get both. The Higgs boson is the easiest boson we can pick up that has a fermion attached to it where we can measure accurately its properties. In all the other cases, the boson is way beyond our capability of measuring given our current technology. So all the attention is focused on trying to discover this Higgs boson. And, you know, they call it the God particle because it would really tie a neat knot over how the fundamental particles come out of the Big Bang creation event. And just like this paper I was discussing, I'm anticipating it's going to give us a whole lot more proof for the supernatural fine-tuning of the particle physics model for the benefit of life and human beings in particular. So yeah, there's a lot of enthusiasm focused on making that. Now, the Large Hadron Collider still is going to have a difficult job detecting the Higgs boson, given the mass range where we think it's going to reside. And probably on the order of a couple of years, it'll need to run. So it's not going to produce the Higgs boson right away. And there's also the possibility that the particle accelerator in Batavia, just outside Chicago, the Fermi Lab particle accelerator, will beat the Large Hadron Collider. And they're working hard to do that. So they're kind of in a race. But the Large Hadron Collider has got 60% more power than the Fermilab Collider. So it's definitely got an edge. But the Fermi boys have been looking for this Higgs boson for several years now. So there's a possibility they could get there first. But there's also the possibility it could take 5 or 10 years before either particle accelerator picks it up. And this is where the optimism comes in. Depending on the models for the Higgs boson, it could have more mass or less mass. If it's got more mass, it's going to be much more challenging to detect. And in a couple of the models, the mass is so high, there's really no possibility we're going to detect it. So we could have spent all that money and not come up with a Higgs boson. On the other hand, there are other particles that things should be able to detect without much difficulty. For example, I've just written a short article for our Connections magazine at Reasons to Believe, making the point that the discovery of sterile neutrinos in particle physics would be a huge advance for establishing a biblical particle creation and a cause. Hadron Collider to solve the sterile neutrino problem than the Higgs boson problem. But understanding how the physics community operates, I know they're going to go after the Higgs first and the sterile neutrino next, mainly because the astronomers have an excellent chance of beating out the particle accelerators and discovering the sterile neutrino, because it radiates a particular X-ray line that we've got an excellent chance of detecting in the halos of big galaxies. And there's an effort on board to do that very thing. By the way, anyone who discovers the sterile neutrino or the Higgs boson will get the Nobel Prize. That much I can tell you for sure. There's a Nobel Prize there to be won. But it's probably going to be shared with hundreds of investigators. Go ahead. Correct.
And you have this number in your book, infinity to infinity power. So the question arises, does infinity exist?
Well, the point I made in Beyond the Cosmos is that Given what the Bible says about God, we should not limit him to a single order infinity. And so I introduced the mathematical concept of geometric infinities, where instead of having an infinite number of possibilities running in a linear fashion, you've got an infinite number of possibilities running in two different dimensions. So it's infinity to the infinity power. And or you can add more infinities. Oh, yeah, make it, instead of just having two dimensions of infinity, you can have three dimensions of infinity or a million dimensions of infinity. So what I'm trying to do in that book is really blow your mind as to how big and powerful God really is. The whole point is he can create and remove any number of space and time dimensions he chooses, and it's possible that he is creating and removing dimensions that have nothing to do with space and time. When it says that you can't think or imagine how great and wonderful it is, I think that's kind of where it's taking us. But my whole point is, if all you do is invoke three dimensions of time, that's enough to provide a solution to the paradox of human free choice and divine predestination. God could do it in much more dramatic ways, but that's a simple way it can be dealt with. Well, that's been a point of debate amongst mathematical philosophers. Is infinity even a real concept? And again, the point I'm making beyond the cosmos is I think these mathematical philosophers are right when they conclude it's not a real experience for the universe or for humanity. And therefore, we can actually use that against certain philosophers who are trying to wiggle around some of the scientific evidence for the God of the Bible, particularly the Big Bang singularity, the beginning of space and time, by invoking these actual infinities, by pointing out actual infinities only apply to the causal agent of space and time. They don't apply to entities that are confined within the space-time dimensions or the surface of the universe. So for us human beings, in terms of what we can do within this universe, or what natural process can do, it's limited to countable numbers, not uncountable numbers. In other words, you can invoke extremely large numbers, but not infinitely large numbers. They must be countable numbers, not uncountable numbers. An uncountable number should be an actual infinity, which would be something that would be the private prerogative of God himself. Only the one, the entity that created space and time, could we conclude, would have that capability. We would not. So when people speculate, well, maybe there's an infinite number of universes, what I can say in response to them, if you're going to use that as an argument against the design of the universe, keep in mind that you're going to be looking at a countable number of universes. So how many universes do you need to overcome this supernatural fine-tuning? And if the number is extremely large, we can argue that that's not realistic.
I asked you a question about the solar eclipse of the moon. And you mentioned something about resonance, that the moon is resonant. It's going to be out of resonance in 100,000 years. What I'm getting at, Adam was created 40,000 years ago. Are we living in this window of opportunity now where it took that 4.3 billion years of the Earth to get everything ready for this time for unity, to put the oil in the ground? And does that mean that we just have, we only have 100,000 years where we'll be able to exist on this planet, which would mean that Jesus would have to be coming back in the next 40,000 years or 50,000 years?
I think you're on the right track. That's exactly what I'm talking about in the book Creation of Science, is that it takes an enormous amount of time, given the laws of physics, to prepare a planet with the necessary resources to launch human civilization. But those same parameters of the universe limit the window of time in which human civilization can be sustained. And that window of time is only a few tens of thousands of years wide. I don't think I was referring to, because you know, the resonance problems for the moon are a long ways back in the past and a long ways into the future. What I was referring to was how the sun enters an extremely stable luminosity phase that we can determine began through neutrino experiments about 50,000 years ago. And those same neutrino experiments tell us that extreme luminosity stability in the solar radiation will be sustained for about 50,000 more years. So we can count on this 100,000-year window in which the sun has this extreme stability, which is really what you want to sustain global human civilization. And that happens when the sun is almost perfectly middle-aged. So it explains why you have to wait 4.5 billion years in the history of the sun before you put human beings here on planet Earth. Now, if you're talking bacteria, they can handle a lot of solar instability, but we human beings can't. And in creationist science, I list about 30 different time windows that must be tuned in order to successfully launch and sustain global human civilization. And I use that as an argument for why you need the God of the Bible to explain these characteristics, because the amazing thing is all these time windows line up right now. And from a naturalistic perspective, the fact that you would have all these time windows lining up at one epoch rather than scattering all over the cosmic calendar tells us that this must be something that's controlled by a brilliant mind. Well, I mean, there are scientists who are making the point that, you know, we're going to sustain human civilization for, say, another 20,000 years. Wouldn't we be wiser to save all that petroleum to make plastic? Because, you know, if we burn up all those fossil fuels, we're not going to have those hydrocarbons to make plastic. Although you can make them out of coal. Just a little more challenging to make them from coal than from petroleum. But there have been people who say, well, you know, if the Lord is going to come back in 1,000 years or less, then we won't have to worry about running out of oil. We'll have plenty of oil. But, of course, people are, you're now aware, worried about pollution and global warming and all that kind of stuff. And, you know, I've been on the radio a lot making the point that before we pass draconian legislation to deal with fossil fuel burning, we need to make sure we got a good solution. You know, my real concern is that we're going to come up with a solution we can't enforce and will make the situation worse rather than better. And it's based on a principle that I lay out in the book Creationist Science, that what we see in the record of nature is evidence of a creator who has designed the universe and the earth in such a way that when we human beings run into these kinds of problems, like stem cells and fossil fuel burning, He has in advance provided us with a solution that is optimally ethical and optimally economical. However, the human tendency is to always pursue, at least initially, the solution that's quick and easy and dirty. And rather, we need to have the patience and the research effort to search out the optimal solution rather than settle for a solution that will make things worse rather than better.
Seems that they're
Well, let me say a word about that. And, you know, this is something, I was part of a Caltech group about 30 years ago. We were talking about this. And, you know, if the choice is between getting electricity from burning coal or from nuclear fission, it's actually a more ethical solution to use nuclear fission than it is to use coal for the following reason. When you burn coal, that coal is loaded with uranium and thorium. And when you burn that coal, it releases not only uranium and thorium to the environment, but radon to the environment. And so if you burn a lot of coal, you're going to expose the population and the plants that they're using for food to a lot of radiation. And if you compare the radiation exposure you get from burning coal to the radiation exposure you get from nuclear fission, coal is worse by many orders of magnitude. So in that context, you're better off, like the French have figured out, to build a lot of nuclear power reactors and not burn coal. On the other hand, I would argue that there's a better solution than either of those. If we're willing to do the research and look for it, we'll find a better solution to either nuclear fission or burning coal. But again, the human tendency is to always go first for the quick and easy and dirty solution. Well, there is some hope there. I mean, what I found fascinating, this is a study that goes back a year, is they're actually coming up with bacteria that feed on nuclear waste. Amazing. Now, where do you think those bacteria came from? I mean, I can't imagine from an evolutionary perspective that you would get bacteria evolving that feed on uranium and thorium. That just doesn't make sense. But we actually do see in the environment bacteria that eat radioactive material. And what's wonderful is that they will take this radioactive material that's soluble in water and convert it to ore deposits that are insoluble, which means you have these bacteria eating these radioactive wastes, and as a result of their life cycle, they produce ore deposits that are insoluble for water, which means they're not going to get into our food supply or a drinking supply, and that means later on we can mine them and use that radioactive material for supporting industry. And so these, yeah, the bacteria can, we can't do it, but the bacteria can. So there's actually a research effort underway to see if we can cultivate these bacteria to process these kinds of waste. Now we're not there yet. But the amazing thing is that we even have those kinds of bacteria in the environment. I mean, how do you explain that unless there's a creator that put that there in advance for us?
My turn, Bertrand. It's been claimed by some scientists that string theory may not be falsifiable and may have no predictive power. Is there any truth to this claim? And I'd like to add, what are the theological implications of string theory?
Well, there are certain components of string theory that at this point can't be put to the test. But it's an overstatement to say that there are no parts of string theory that can be put to the test. And again, you can look at beyond the cosmos. I list 8 predictions from string theory that we've been able to experimentally verify. So in that sense, it's an overstatement to say that string theory has no place in the physics department. It really does. And I would argue that the evidence that there are extra dimensions that explain why we have a universe with the physics that we do is very well established. That part of string theory, in my opinion, is beyond any reasonable shadow of doubt. On the other hand, it's quite clear we don't have a complete string theory available at this time, and probably never will, based on the energy levels we're looking at to do the kinds of experimental tests that would really bring some bearing on it. Where I've got hope is if we can detect and measure gravity waves. There's a whole set of string theory predictions that can be put to the test if we've got fairly accurate gravity wave measurements. And there's already operating in Louisiana and the state of Washington a gravity wave detector. And if we're lucky enough to observe a couple of neutron stars or black holes merge together, this instrument will detect the gravity wave signal from that event. And that's basically what physicists are doing. They're waiting for some dramatic event in the nearby universe that will generate gravity waves powerful enough we'll be able to pick it up. Well, the graviton is extremely difficult to detect. You're talking about building a particle accelerator that will detect a graviton. Let's see, I'd have to calculate what you would need. You would need 40 trillion miles times 10 million. That's how long of a particle accelerator you would need in order to detect a graviton. So I don't think that's going to happen until the Democrats take control of all branches of the government. That won't be funded. Now, to put this in perspective, the particle accelerator outside of Chicago is 4 miles long. And I don't think we're ever going to fund anything bigger than that. I mean, there was that thing to fund that 57-mile-long particle accelerator in Texas. It was going to be $9 billion. But our government said too much money. So the graviton is way beyond human detectability. But the gravity wave is something that realistically could be detected. And as I mentioned, there's this gravity wave telescope that can pick it up. What will probably be even more successful will be the next release of the WMAP. The WMAP data was tantalizingly close to picking up the gravity wave signal. So the next release may pick it up. It's a long shot, but it may pick it up. And the Planck satellite that's scheduled for launch in a few years has got an excellent probability of detecting gravity waves. Well, true, but you know, science has never been able to compete with wars. I mean, I'm a scientist. I'm not disagreeing with you. But I know how hard it is to persuade government officials to heavily invest in pure scientific research. And you're also fighting all the biologists, too. I mean, keep in mind there's 15 biologists for every physicist. And they've been complaining for years about how the physicists get an unfair share of the research budget. So there's actually scientists arguing that we astronomers and physicists need to get less money rather than more money. So, who's next?
Flowers.
Flowers.
I've just been recently reading some of Darwin's writings, and he couldn't come up with an explanation for flowers. Is that really a paradox or something that we don't have an answer for as far as evolution is concerned?
Well, what's difficult to explain about flowers from an evolutionary perspective is the cost that certain plants put into producing the flowers. You know, in the latest issue of Science, they got on the front cover a picture of a flower that's a meter in diameter. Can you imagine a plant producing a flower that's a meter in diameter? A lot of cost goes into that plant of producing that flower. What does the plant get from it? And that's something that Darwin made the point of, is that, by the way, you get the same problem with seeds and fruit, is that from an evolutionary perspective, there really is no explanation for why plants produce seeds with so much food value and nutrition. They don't need that for the plant. Or likewise the fruit. And so this is the example we call altruistic behavior. And so these plants produce these beautiful large flowers to attract insects. And they also provide a lot of nectar for those insects. And the insects go away and make all this honey and stuff. And the honey is used to support other life forms. And the whole point is, why does the plant need to do that? From its own selfish perspective. And so that's the main critique of Darwinism, is it's based on selfish greed. And, you know, if the plant is simply operating from a selfish, greedy perspective, I'm only going to provide for my own needs and the needs of nobody else, why would it produce these showy flowers? And why would it spend so much energy making those flowers? And why all the fruit? And why all the seeds? Well, there's even such situations as trees that produce fruit with no seeds in it. There you've got a plant that's getting no benefit from the fruit it produces. So, you know, how do you deal with that? They're not man-made. I mean, we can make fruit that doesn't have seeds by breeding it, but we're talking about natural plants where there's been no human breeding, and they produce fruit without seeds in it. You know, from an evolutionary perspective, that should not happen. That would have been weeded out immediately as being something that's wasteful. I mean, that's kind of the Darwinian principle. Where there's waste, it gets removed. But from a creator perspective, you're going to want plants that produce food in great abundance so that you can sustain animals. If the plants only produced what they needed, then you wouldn't be able to have this huge diversity and population of animal life on our planet. So it's one thing to explain the altruism of human beings. It's quite another thing to explain the altruism of a plant that doesn't have a mind.
Well, I got a question from myself this time. I just got through reading Francis Collins' book, and now I can't remember the name of it. What is it, Hugh?
I can't remember the name of it either, but I don't know the book you're talking about.
Yeah, he's the head of the Human Genome Project, and his book is basically, he's a Christian, but he is a supporter of the idea of theistic evolution, which is more kind of a deistic idea that God sort of wound the universe up and tuned it so finely at the very beginning that it was set up for evolution to take place with the result of human beings at the end of the process. I guess my question is, if he turned out to be right, that God did use an evolutionary process to produce us instead of individual miracles, miraculous creation of individual species, how would that change RTB's creation model, and how would it change your view of God? Would it be a big deal to you in the great scheme of things?
Well, we did interview Francis Collins on our Creation Update webcast, and it's archived. You can all listen to the interview we had of him. Unfortunately, I was out of town when the interview took place, so I didn't get to participate, but Buzz Rana and Dave Rogstad and one of other scholars, Ken Samples, talked to him. It's a good interview. And he told me in advance that he really appreciates the work of Reasons to Believe. So he likes what we're doing. Mm-hmm. And it was a very friendly interchange that we had with him. And one thing that we've observed over the years is that typically with theistic evolutionists, you can talk to them at a rational level. They don't get as emotional as the atheists or the young earth creationists. And, you know, they're willing to give. I mean, what I notice about Francis Collins is, you know, if we turn out to be right, he's okay with that. If he turns out to be right, then we can make adjustments in our model to accommodate that to a limit. I mean, you know, where I would draw the line is that I read the Bible and I look at the scientific evidence and recognize that both point very directly to the fact that we human beings are distinct from all other animal life. So we cannot have strictly evolved from animal life. And I thought it would have been interesting if my colleagues had asked Francis Collins those questions about the spirit component of humanity. Instead, they're all talking about the DNA. And, you know, the scripture isn't clear exactly how God uses DNA. I mean, one interesting part of the discussion is that it's clear that God used DNA from Adam in the construction project of Eve. He took a biopsy from Adam's side. There would have been DNA in there. And as we look at the DNA of all life, we see that there's common design, that the design we see in the pig or the chimpanzee is frequently repeated in the human genome. 35% of our genome is identical to that of the daffodil. However, it's a mistake, in my opinion, to claim that we evolved from daffodils. Of course, we share a lot of DNA similarity with daffodils because we're using the same metabolic reactions and it's going to be governed by the same proteins. And from my perspective, a creator comes up with an optimal design for a liver is going to use that optimal design over and over again in different species of life. And so that explains why we can take a baboon heart and put it in a human being. It's got basically the same design features, and you've got interchangeable parts. You know, and the point that Fuzz Rana makes is that we human beings are created in the image of God, and therefore it should come to us as no shock that we tend to design things the same way God does. And so years ago we came up with interchangeable parts for, you know, factory manufacture. Well, God uses interchangeable parts as well. And I think where we're going with Francis Collins is he's clearly a little further over to the evolutionary side than we are. But the whole point is he would agree with us that God does use these DNA designs over and over again. The question is, can we look at Scripture and look at the scientific record and see where he does and where he doesn't? And in that context, the Bible does allow room for natural process DNA exchange at the level of the lower plants and the animals. You know, let the land produce plants, for example. Let the oceans teem with life. But when it comes to birds, mammals, and human beings, it uses verbs that, in my opinion, demand direct supernatural intervention. So the soul that we see in the birds and mammals, the soulishness of birds and mammals, their mind, will, and emotions, according to Genesis 1, did not come about by evolution from lower life forms. Now, you might be able to argue that the physical bodies of these creatures did, but not the soulishness. Likewise, you could argue that there's something about the physical nature of humanity that came about through, you know, borrowing genetic content from other species. But the spirit nature of humanity would not fall into that category. According to Genesis 1, the text uses the word bara to create something brand new that never existed before. That would be supernatural. And I kind of wish my colleagues had asked Francis Collins those questions. I also suspect that Francis Collins would require divine miraculous intervention for the origin of life. And it'd been fun to ask him those questions. Now, we're going to have a wonderful opportunity, because at the University of Florida in the fall, we're going to be defending, when I say we, it'll be myself and Fuzz Rana, will be defending our biblical creation model in front of the students and faculty at the University of Florida. And we're setting up a skeptics panel to critique our model. And we have asked Francis Collins to sit in that panel, and I think he's going to accept the invitation. So we'll have another opportunity to see how this unfolds. But he went on our creation update because he says, I really like what you guys are doing. So I think this is something where we're going to get some resolution if we just keep working on it.
One of the arguments he makes that I thought was pretty interesting was from a theological standpoint. He said, if you look at the history of miracles, even as the Bible teaches it, God uses them pretty sparsely.
Right.
And that RTB's creation model would require the independent creation of however many species of life there have been on planet Earth as separate individual miraculous events. And his model would require much fewer miracles.
Well, that's true. And I think the way you settle the dispute is get the DNA evidence. I mean, he's a DNA expert. And that's one thing that Fuzz and Francis did get to talk about is that, you know, in his model, he would argue that the genomes of advanced life are filled with lots of truly junk DNA. I noticed in listening to the interview, it seemed to be where all the focus was. Whereas you notice in both Who is Adam and Creationist Science, we argue that there's very little true junk, that almost all of it is function and purpose. And both Fuzz and I were rather surprised that Francis Collins wasn't aware of the research that went into our conclusion that virtually everything has been identified as junk actually has a purpose. But I think that's a symptom of the fact that Francis Collins is a true scientist. as a true scientist functioning in the lab, which I myself don't do, he is forced to specialize on a very narrow point of a human genome analysis, and as a result is not aware of the studies that have been done outside of his narrow discipline. But both Buzz and I think that he would be very open to, you know, getting up to date in what's going on there. And, you know, as Buzz points out, research on this so-called junk DNA is advancing rapidly. That we're kind of eager to get a second edition out for Who is Adam, because the case is much stronger than what we stated in our book, based on the discoveries of the past few months. But we're hoping that'll have an effect on people like Francis Collins.
I don't want to throw it off, but I got asked this question about the Apostle Paul in his last days in Rome. I've been doing some work studying, and I see that he called for Luke, John Mark, Peter shows up, and Matthew shows up. I don't know if they all show up at the same time, but could they have? And did he ask those two specifically to show up to bring the writings of the New Testament that were currently available for a testimony?
Well, that's an interesting piece of speculation because, yeah, if you look at 2 Timothy, which is probably the last book he wrote, and he wrote it when he was under the sentence of death, and he knew death was coming.
Did he request that John Mark show up as well?
He did. And, you know, there's some... You know, I've even wondered if Mark, late in his life, wrote the book of Hebrews.
I do, too.
I mean, that's one speculation I've had. You know, people have said, no, it wasn't written by Mark. But Mark wrote the gospel when he was a young man. And if he wrote Hebrews when he was an old man, that might explain the two books.
Could Matthew's documents have been brought to Rome because he wrote the Aramaic version, according to some of the writings I'm talking about, as early as 40 and 45, and the Greek 50 and 55?
Well, certain linguists have argued that none of the New Testament documents were ever written in Aramaic, that they were penned in Greek and distributed in Greek. So there's a lot of dispute about the Catholic idea that the Aramaic came out first. And Gleason Archer, in particular, has argued that the Greek New Testament books are free of any of the Aramaic word pictures. He said if there was an Aramaic original, we would see that creeping into the Greek, and he says there's no evidence of it at all. Neither the Palestinian Aramaic or the Babylonian Aramaic. And therefore, he has argued that these documents never appeared in the Aramaic language until after the Greek had already been well established. That the Greek must have come first. There are three fragments of the Gospel of Matthew that have been carbon 14 dated to around 60 AD. They're very tiny fragments, but nevertheless, that does give credence to the idea that the book of Matthew would have had to have been available previous to 60 AD. That's the earliest carbon 14 dated fragments of Bible manuscripts I'm aware of. We have some of the Gospel of John that date as early as 119 AD.
Was Paul, Peter, and Matthew there at the same time? Approximately where they could have
been
together?
Well, kind of the scholarly opinion is that the first New Testament book written was probably the book of Mark. And they're saying it was probably written in the early 40s AD. So that would have come out, you know, just after the crucifixion, the resurrection of Jesus. And then that Matthew would have been next. And then who knows the other books. And probably the last books are the books that John wrote.
Is Paul referring to the actual written gospel when he refers?
Well, what it says in 2 Timothy, he says, you know, bring the scrolls.
Yeah.
Now, there's nothing in 2 Timothy that tells us what scrolls he's referring to. But based on the emotional content of that verse, these are scrolls that Paul desperately wanted to read before he was going to be killed. So there must have been some very important, and you know, people have speculated, as if you pointed out, that maybe these were brand new inspired writings of the New Testament, and he had hadn't had a chance to see these yet, and he wanted to see them.
I forget if it's in Thessalonians or First or the Corinthians, where Paul refers to this gospel that's been presented to you. Do you think he may have been referring to the actual written scripture?
He may have. So, clearly before he was dead, there were gospel accounts in written form. Yeah. Well, I've got a couple of books in my office that kind of try to take that problem on. And they do it by trying to take all four Gospels and synthesize them into a consistent testimony. Kind of like what you would do with a traffic accident. You've got half a dozen witnesses and you try to figure out what each one saw. And clearly when you read the four Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, each one is selecting different parts of the story to tell. So none of them teaches the whole story. You just get pieces of it. In fact, John, who wrote the Gospel of John, was the last of the Gospel writers, said, you know, the life of Jesus would fill more books than we could possibly write. There is a research group out of, Western Conservative Baptist Seminary in Portland, Oregon. Produced a book a number of years called The Life of Christ in Stereo. It's still available, Life of Christ in Stereo. And what they've done is they've gone through the four Gospels and have concluded that the ministry of Jesus from the beginning until his crucifixion took 4 years rather than three. And they did that through analysis of the Passovers that were celebrated. So the traditional story is that he ministered for 3 years. But they said if it's only 3 years, they perceive contradictions amongst the four gospel writers. But if they make it a four-year ministry, the contradictions are all removed. And I've read the book. I think they got a very good case for a four-year ministry. And what was really going on in the first year of Christ's ministry, he was building his team of disciples. You know, and that would make sense, that you would take considerable time to build that team of disciples before launching into a public ministry. But by that means, they get all the Passovers to work. And then I also have a book that was actually the doctoral thesis of a theology student, and they wound up turning it into a book, which tries to figure out the year that Jesus ended his ministry. And the way they do that is they make note of the fact that Jesus said himself, "I'll be in the tomb 3 days and three nights." And there's an Old Testament reason for the 3 days and the three nights. The point was that a prophet could raise somebody from the dead as long as they hadn't been dead, any more than 3 days. And so if it was a day or a day and a half, a prophet like Elijah could raise somebody from the dead. And indeed, Old Testament prophets did rise people from the dead, but they hadn't been dead that long. And so on that basis, it was critical that Jesus actually be in the tomb for 72 hours in order to prove that this was a divine miracle rather than something a prophet would be able to pull off. For the same reason, Jesus waited till the fourth day before he raised Lazarus, again proving that he was God by raising Lazarus from the dead. And so on that basis, they say the traditional story that Jesus was killed on Friday before the Passover and raised on Sunday after the Passover has got to be incorrect. You know, that's the traditional way we celebrate Easter. And what this student made note of is that during Passover week, you get a number of Sabbaths. You get a Sabbath for the beginning of Passover, a Sabbath for the end of Passover, and you get the regular Sabbath. And you know, depending on the phase of the moon, you're going to get the Passover Sabbath starting at different times and ending at different times. And so what this gentleman did is he kind of surveyed the calendar at the time of Caesar Augustus and thereafter, and looked for dates in which you would get a Sabbath on Thursday and a Sabbath on Saturday. And so his analysis was to conclude, based on the gospel accounts, that Jesus was crucified and died on Wednesday and was raised bodily from the dead on Sunday morning. And this would make everything that you see in the gospel accounts consistent. Then he asked the question, on what dates do we get a Thursday Sabbath for the end of Passover week and a regular Sabbath on a Saturday? And in his thesis, he produced two different years where it would work. And I can't remember off the top of my head what those 2 years are. Yeah, he claimed to have found two different years that were possible. Yeah. While it's not an easy solution because people come up with different formulas for the phases of the moon and the beginning of Passover, and we don't have records at that time, either in the Jewish records or the Roman records, as to exactly how they were working their calendars. So there is a little bit of uncertainty in these kinds of calculations. But all he was doing in his thesis was showing that without doubt we do have a Thursday-Saturday Sabbath that fits in the right time period based on everything else we know about the life of Jesus. So his whole objective in writing the thesis is to show that his explanation of a Thursday Sabbath and a Saturday Sabbath is a reasonable suggestion to make. I've got a copy. You're welcome. It's out of print. I'm not going to let it out of my office, but you can photocopy it. Oh, yeah, it's. I would guess it's about 350 pages, 400 pages. So it's not a trivial document. But, being a thesis, all he did is he took his thesis and had a publisher make a book like this. And so there's a lot of material in there that's got nothing to do with the two Sabbaths. He's got a bunch of other stuff in there, too.
I don't have real clarity on this thought, but I was just thinking about the potential for evil. And, of course, God existing before, never having a beginning or an end. And thus, at some point in time, he creates beings, angelic beings, as far as I know on the record, that have the potential for evil. Satan and those that followed him being those. And then creating us with that same potential. So, that in his God being perfect and good and right and just, nothing but good, God, only God is good, so nothing evil comes from God. So that even the creation, the potential for evil, brings about the potential for us to enter into a relationship and a perfect point in relationship with God, to where there is no potential for evil.
Right.
And so our place is merely to know that we are created for his good pleasure, and his good pleasure is perfect and right and just. But the concept of the potential for evil seems perplexing, but I understand how it fits, because it allows for his good pleasure and us to come through to that place where there is that perfect relationship, that completed relationship with the being that he's chosen to create. Does that make any sense?
Well, it does, and I've used the analogy of trying to raise a child and educate a child and eventually get that child to the point where it, quote, can't fail. And the whole point there is that if you want to get a child to the point where it can't fail, you have to offer him or her the potential to fail. And likewise, God does the same thing with us. I mean, he gave us free will. And he obviously gave us free will because he wanted his creatures to be able to experience and express love. And without that free will, there is no potential for love. But having granted us free will, there's a risk that we would use that free will to promote evil rather than good. And evil came. But God had a plan set up in advance to use that evil as a tool to bring about an eternally secure relationship with him. And the point I make in Beyond the Cosmos, there can be no eternal security without being exposed and tested by evil. And the value of the eternal security that God offers us is that we get exposed to the greatest evil that's possible and the greatest temptation that's possible. You know, I argue it's no accident that the author of evil is the most powerful of God's creatures.